Okay, well, that is the title of this talk. I guess I should apologize for two things in coming here. First of all, I guess I thought when I came here that I was no longer a card-carrying member of the string theory fraternity. But I heard on Tuesday that at least I'm now well known for not solving a very interesting problem. So the second thing is that this talk is somewhat lower on scientific content than most of the talks in this series, and somewhat higher on exhortation. But I think the exhortation is very important, so I hope you take it seriously. And it's not all, of the exhortation is specifically about linear colliders, although a lot of it will be. So the outline of the talk is very simple. I'd like to say a few words about the general question of why string theory needs experiment. I'd then like to say a number of things about why string theory needs a future E plus E minus linear collider. And finally, and this is what I warned you about, I want to tell you some things about what you guys ought to be doing about it.
Political.
Okay. So, let me first say a few words about this first question. String theory has a strong claim to be the underlying theory of nature, and you folks all have your own favorite list of these. I've produced a few items here that are familiar to you. We know, as you heard in my talk yesterday, that there's a very strong experimental basis for the statement that Young-Mills interactions supply the basic interactions of particle physics, and they naturally come out of string theory in a unified way with some kind of fundamental underpinning. String theory is the only known quantum theory of gravity with a well-defined perturbation expansion. It gives some kind of prima facie explanation of the black hole entropy in terms of statistical mechanics. And particular solutions of string theory give predictions for the low-energy gauge group, the number of fermion generations, the Yukawa couplings, and similar quantities. Basically, there isn't any other candidate for getting these kinds of predictions out of a fundamental theory. And so it seems to me that it is extremely interesting to pursue the question of whether string theory is the fundamental theory of nature. But on the other hand, we don't know exactly which string degrees of freedom are going to turn out to be the standard model gauge bosons, quarks, and leptons. For example, in 1985, when David Gross wrote his famous paper on the subject, these were, of course, the closed string degrees of freedom of the heterotic string. Nowadays, one might say that the gauge bosons here are some brain-bound gauge bosons or bosons bound to some other objects. We'd like to have some clue about that. And we'd also like to know, how do we prove that string theory is the right story? Are there phenomena in nature that are distinctly stringy that we can have access to? I don't have good answers to these questions, which I'm going to propose today, but I'd like to basically tell you that it's very likely that some discovery and experiment will eventually be needed to sort these things out. Historically, we know that in 1954, Young and Mills wrote down this beautiful set of field equations, which in their paper they applied to exactly the wrong physical context. They tried to gauge isospin. It took, in fact, 20 years and considerable input from experiment to find the correct connection between Young-Mills theory and the strong and weak interactions. Well, since David is here and can lecture about this to you at great length, I will not try and tell you the whole story, which is extremely complicated and intricate, about the interaction between these theoretical ideas and experiment. But just as two examples, I'd like to point out that the maximal parity violation in mu decay, which led to V minus A, and scaling in deep and elastic electron scattering, which led to asymptotic freedom, were two astounding and surprising results, probably without which the whole picture couldn't have been put together. And I'd also like to remind you that in 1954, no one could anticipate that these were the right experiments. In fact,
it is anticipated because you can imagine what would have happened.
Yeah.
It's always a mistake to look at a particular historical path and say, it had to be that way.
Okay.
The biologist will tell you that about the genome.
No, that's fine.
And it could have been that it hadn't been for the H-bomb and we didn't have all that money to build this machine. That one could have relied on similar conclusions.
Well, I just think that these two phenomena are particularly striking examples of things that no one really expected at the time.
Okay. I'm just saying it doesn't mean that you couldn't have arrived there. It's an interesting question.
Yeah. And, of course, the other thing about these two was that in the 50s, no one anticipated that those would be the crucial experiments. Essentially, we had to measure the whole effect of Lagrangian to find out that these were the key pieces of information.
I thought Susskind had made some wild claims. No study needed to be done after Maxwell.
Yes, he made that claim here, in fact, and there's a reference to it later in the talk.
Even all of that could be.
In Lenny's papers, Landau knew that non-asymptotically free theories didn't make sense.
Yeah, but he can't be wrong.
He can't just talk about that, but he didn't know that.
Okay. So similarly, to find the correct way to interpret string theory, we will probably need some kind of surprising and crucial advice from experiment. And I guess what I'd like to point out to you is that whereas there are some very important experiments which will certainly be done, and here I put the LHC and searches for cold dark matter as two things that I think are extremely interesting and are really now sort of ballistic to be completed in a very interesting way, I'd like to tell you about another kind of experiment which, in my own opinion, is really in danger of not being done unless it gets a lot of support from the theoretical community. And my reason for giving this talk is to encourage you to look into this and to make your feelings known about it. So this is the question of future E plus E minus experiments. Those of you who attended my talk yesterday heard that the previous generation of E plus E minus experiments really provide some very elegant and powerful probes into the nature of the particles in the Standard Model. And so, therefore, it's interesting to remind you that this year, the DOE and NSF have asked the U.S. high energy physics community to write a plan both for the near term, the next facility, and the next 20 years. And one of the central questions that the panel doing this planning has to address is, should the community call for construction of a 500 GeV E plus E minus collider as the next major accelerator project? Maybe I should say that in addition to a proposal in the United States, there are proposals in Germany and Japan. However, all of these proposals are coming to a cost of the facility, which is many billions of dollars. Very roughly $5 billion for the machine which would fill this specification. And probably for that much money, you have one machine in the world, it has an international basis, and it requires cooperation of all three regions. Sometimes you hear that the Germans can build this by themselves, but personally, I don't think that's correct. I think that if the United States doesn't come into this business, the German proposal would also fail. And so, I'm sorry? There is a CERN proposal for a linear collider to be built with not yet developed technology after the LHC is done. Okay. What I'm talking about is something that we can start on now.
Michael, are you talking about 500 total or 500 on 500?
The plan is on the next slide. Let me just put it up there. Okay. So, I think, as I've said, I think if the U.S. is going to do this, a strong mandate is needed, and it's probably worth pointing out that OMB has tried to slash the R&D funds from this project in each of the last two fiscal years. Actually, I'm not sure what the current Bush budget says about this. The last version I saw was not sufficiently detailed. But, no, seriously, I mean, it just had major headings, and it didn't get down to this level of specificity. But in previous years, there have been large cuts in the R&D for this project.
What did that
Sorry?
What is that, around a year?
It's something like $20 million a year. So...
Well...
Yeah.
What's requested is...
Okay. So, I think it's interesting to ask if this project is relevant to string theory and if you folks should care about it. And so I'd like to argue that you should, and, well, let's then begin to talk about that. So here is the floor plan that the Next Linear Collider collaboration, so this is the floor plan put down by the group of labs, SLAC, Fermilab, Livermore, and LBL. There are similar, as I say, plans, not entirely identical, from DAISY and from KEK in Japan. The thing is very large. It's you see that from here to here is 5 kilometers. The LINAC are the LINACs, the linear accelerators here are about 10 kilometers each. The idea is that from one side you accelerate an electron, from the other side a positron beam. Collide them here. The angle, of course, is exaggerated. The crossing angle is about 20 milliradians. So roughly it's 2 head-on linear colliders. But there's a lot more detail here than you folks are really interested in. The kind of energies you're talking about are 500 GeV in the initial stage. NLC plan is to have the tunnels and conventional facilities there so that you can readily upgrade it to 1 TeV in the center of mass. Then using what's here called two-beam and what Sergio will call clip technology, you would be able to go to a higher center of mass energy, but with a very substantial modification of what's in these LINACs, but on the same, essentially in the same tunnels. And I think the location is still a matter of controversy, but it seems to be converging that most probably it would be at Fermilab or somewhere near the Fermilab site.
Would it fit on site?
No. It can either be in a deep tunnel whose central region, maybe this would be on the Fermilab site, or there's some cut-and-fill site which is 15 miles west of Fermilab running east-west.
What's the total length?
I think the total length is about 25 kilometers from here to here.
There's a technical reason for the two things being angled, is that right?
That's right. Basically, it's very simple. It's you send down a train of bunches, and you want two bunches to hit each other, but you don't want them to hit the next guy along the line. And so that requirement leads to a roughly 20 milliradian angle between the two beams.
Oh, so the angle is exaggerated.
But, yes, that's what I said. Okay. Okay. So the first question, well, you probably might not ask this question, but I should probably tell you how one would justify this machine to an agnostic experimenter. And I think agnostic experimenters think that this is quite an interesting justification. First of all, you would say that an agnostic experimenter might not believe in the Higgs boson, that it is there or what exactly it is made of. Of course, the precision electroweak measurements, as I told you yesterday, put a rather strong upper bound on the mass of the Higgs boson. So that means that the Higgs boson will be accessible to this machine in the reaction where it recoils against a Z0. This reaction is a very beautiful one for studying the Higgs boson, because if you can find the Z, which occurs at a definite energy if it recoils in the lab against the Higgs boson, then whatever's on the other side is the Higgs boson, and so you can measure all of its branching ratios, and through that, all of its couplings. And so you can measure the Higgs boson coupling to Z pairs, W pairs, B pairs, C pairs, tau pairs, and gluon pairs and photon pairs, if you wish. And the idea is to collect enough information here to really prove that it is this particle whose couplings are responsible for the masses of all of the various species in the standard model. And so even if you don't believe in anything but the Higgs boson, this is a rather interesting experimental program that you could do with this machine. It also allows a precision measurement of the top quark mass and of the couplings of gauge bosons to W and T, this is of interest not to this fraternity, but to people who are interested in strongly coupled models of the Higgs sector. Essentially, these are the crucial things that you want to measure to test strongly coupled models of the Higgs sector. And finally, there's a significant window for the discovery and precision study of new particles. Probably for this audience, supersymmetry is the thing that figures largest here. And all of this is described in a paper that came out last summer. Here's the reference. And you folks can look that up and see what this case looks like as one would present it to sort of your average experimenter.
Is that a review paper?
That's a review paper. So it's Happy X. I'm not sure how many of you have read a Happy X paper. But as they say, if you only read one, you should read this one. Okay. So what I'd like to do is to talk about something very different here. I'd like to talk about what's interesting about this experimental program for string theorists. And so first of all, I'll say some words about the orthodox paradigm, TeV scale supersymmetry. Then a few things about new vector bosons and contact interactions. And finally, some words about the possibility of large extra dimensions. So let's first talk about what I've called here the orthodox paradigm. So this is, let's see. There's some paper by David Gross in which it says that there is no obstacle to going from the heterotic stream to a complete unified theory of nature, and this is pretty much what he means. String theory leads to a low-energy effective field theory with supersymmetry. The string scale is at a rather high scale, somewhere between the grand unification scale and the Planck scale. Maybe we can bring it down to the gut scale and incorporate the unification of couplings naturally in this framework. In any case, from here to where the Higgs vacuum expectation value is what, 15, 14 orders of magnitude. So we have a gauge hierarchy problem, and that has to be solved by supersymmetry. So supersymmetry then has to come down all the way to scales below 1,000 GeV. This scenario, as I said, naturally can incorporate the grand unification of couplings. It also tells us that high-dimension operators come at this high scale, and therefore they're very unimportant. So we expect very little lepton number violation, small neutrino masses, very small baryon number violation. The whole picture actually does fit together very neatly. And, of course, there are many ways of realizing this in string theory, which you folks know better than I. A weak coupling Calabi-Yau type compactification, the Hojava-Witten construction, which would allow M string to come down to M gut, grains in ADS, many, many ways of constructing this general picture within string theory. Now, in this scenario, we expect superpartners to appear below 1 TeV. And the usual arguments for that are, well, soft, but they go like this. What one has to do in order to get a precise estimate for where the superparticle spectrum starts is to try and make quantitative the claim that if supersymmetry is not present at scales of order 100 GeV, then there's no reason for the Higgs boson, the Higgs mass, and the Higgs vacuum expectation value to be of order 100 GeV. And so what people do typically is then assume some rather definite model context. They try to compute the output of the model in terms of a Higgs vacuum expectation value, or here I've written the W mass, in terms of some underlying parameters, and then you get an equation for the W mass in terms of various parameters of the theory. So for example, the mu parameter, the gluino mass, which comes in because it renormalizes the top quark mass, the stop masses, etc. And typically then you get an expression that looks like this. Oh my god, I made a mistake. This should be 1.3 for this particular model. Please excuse me. In any case, with coefficients of order 1 in this expression. And so what you then realize is that if the W mass is 80 GeV, and everything is coming as the square, you might expect mu, the supersymmetric Higgs parameter, and the Gluino mass to be 10 times larger and have the smallness of the W mass explained by a cancellation among these parameters. However, that idea becomes less and less plausible as the supersymmetry spectrum is pushed up to infinity. And so somewhere you come to a limit on where the superparticles can be with reasonable plausibility. Now, this is not a limit. This is only a plausibility argument. But nevertheless, when you open up the literature and you ask what people predict for superparticle masses for reasonable parameters in a wide variety of model contexts, those masses come out in the few hundred GeV range. And in fact, in most...
Historically, I would say they come out 5 GeV on the current experimental limit.
No, that's not true. I think the idea of charginos between, let's say, 50 and 200 is consistent from the very beginning of the subject.
Not at all.
Okay.
Where are you going back to 5A?
No, papers circum-mid 80s. People wanted light proteins.
Well, I mean, there is, of course, a parallel literature where every time an anomaly is discovered in an experiment, then you find that corner of the parameter space which allows things to be sufficiently light. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about where generically the parameters should be. Of course, when Carlo Rubbia discovered supersymmetry, there was an enormous spate of papers saying that supersymmetric particles were at 40 GeV. But we're not talking about that part. We're talking about the general model expectations. So in any Okay, well, in any case, what I would say is that in the paper that I referred you to before, there is, my version of the history of this subject with references, and anyone can go there and see whether you think I'm right or wrong. So I encourage you to do that. In any case, with that as my defense, I will stand by this claim that most supersymmetric models have a lightish chargino below 250 GeV. And I'm certainly not claiming that this is an upper limit, but I'm saying that a collider which eventually has a capability of 1 TeV is a very reasonable place to look for those superparticles that don't have color charge. In any case, all this maybe is a little moot because it is also well known that in these kinds of orthodox scenarios, supersymmetry is very easy to find at the LHC. And so when the LHC experiments turn on, if we're lucky, we will see very large signals with multi-jets and missing energy, which will tell us that there's new particle production, that the supersymmetric particles are appearing, and that we have to think about what's the next step. And I think for string theorists, probably it's only at the next step where the story becomes interesting. Now,
since you brought it up, let me just ask that.
Yes.
If the LHC does get lucky and find the light Higgs, will it also do a reasonable job of measuring some of those couplings you mentioned earlier?
That's a very interesting question. The LHC can measure some but not all of the Higgs branching ratios. The problem basically is that whereas in an E plus E minus environment, the Higgs is seen recoiling against a Z, which is itself a very beautiful signature of Higgs production. In the LHC, you actually have to find the Higgs under typically enormous backgrounds from strong interaction processes. So I think, and maybe Sergio can correct me if I'm wrong, the Higgs to BB bar, the dominant branching ratio for a light Higgs, cannot be seen at the LHC. There are some claims that you can see it recoiling against a W, but I think those claims are not accepted by the LHC experimentalists themselves. The Higgs to W star, ZZ star, and tau plus tau minus, there are claims that you can see those in various ways. Of course, the way you discover the Higgs at the LHC is by looking for Higgs to 2-photon, which is a very rare decay mode. It goes through a loop And the only, what you get out of that is the sigma times branching ratio, the production cross-section, which is another loop process involving glue-glue going to the Higgs, and then this branching ratio into gamma-gamma. People have thought about how to study the ratios of branching ratios for W pairs, Z pairs, and taus. And those things can probably be determined to 10% accuracy, the ratio of branching ratios. I don't know of any way at the LHC you can do this kind of systematic program where you march through all of the various decay modes.
Mike?
Yes?
I'm thinking of the exchange you just had with Mark. I mean, it seems that what you might want to do is quantify most. So you have a parameter space.
Yes.
You have to decide on the probability density of the parameter space.
Well,
most is bigger than 50%.
So if you actually look in this HEPI-X reference, you'll see a table of papers in the literature that have done that and the estimates they obtain from the measures they've chosen. It's a very well explored and somewhat inconclusive subject, but you'll see what people have done. And I think the weight of those arguments supports this conclusion, I would say.
There is actually an upper limit that one can put on these numbers if you assume the lightest particle is stable. Because as you raise everybody's mass, eventually that particle will overclose the universe.
Ah, that's right. But that's a very weak limit. That's several TeV.
That's several TeV. But it is at least a scientific limit rather than a plausibility, how much you dislike the theory.
No, that's absolutely true. But it's also, but I'd also make the statement that if you said we have to be able to get there in order to begin this program, you wouldn't begin it now, you'd begin it 15 years from now. And I think that's the wrong answer. So, as you folks all know, the standard model has the famous 19 parameters plus neutrino mass, many of which are well known to you. The coupling constants, the quark masses and CKM angles, lepton masses, the Higgs mass and couplings. Supersymmetry, before we talk about supersymmetry breaking, add some and subtract some. But basically, one is left, if you really talk about the fundamental parameters of Lagrangian, with a relatively limited repertoire. Most of the parameters are in here. And this pattern of quark and lepton masses is, if you like, famously inconclusive about what the underlying fundamental theory is. There are lots of theories about how you generate the quark and lepton masses. People have been thinking about this literally for 25 years. And there's been relatively little insight, I think, into what the underlying theory is that comes from that. So if we want to learn more things about fundamental physics, we need to measure more effective Lagrangian parameters. And if there is supersymmetry, then there are many more from the effective description of supersymmetry breaking. So in particular, the masses associated with the various gauginos, the masses associated with the various superpartners, and what are called A and B terms, the B term being the this scalar addition to the Lagrangian having to do with the Higgs, and the A terms having to do with essentially mixing of three scalars of the structure of the Yukawa coupling. I should say that these parameters in general could be matrices, but the amount of off-diagonal content is typically highly restricted by flavor-changing neutral current constraints. The pattern of these softly generated masses can have an interesting dependence on, it may depend slightly on flavor. It can have a very non-trivial dependence on standard model quantum numbers, and I'll just remind you of some examples of that as we proceed. And then I should also remind you that because of basically mass sum rules, supersymmetry breaking cannot arise in a sector which is directly coupled to the standard model particles. It has to be transmitted either by radiative corrections or by gravity. So that then lends some complication to theories of supersymmetry breaking. Basically, it says that supersymmetry breaking has to come from an isolated sector and be represented in standard model physics by an effective Lagrangian of the kind that I've written here. So the interesting thing about these parameters as opposed to, let's say, the Yukawa couplings or the quark and lepton masses, is that, of course, not knowing what these parameters are or what experiment is really going to tell us about them, we can hope that these parameters actually have some interpretation in terms of the underlying geometry of the mechanism of supersymmetry breaking. And actually, there are some interesting examples that people have discussed in the past few years. One of them is Hojava's mechanism, or the generalization of it, called Gugino mediation. The standard model and the hidden sector live on different brains separated by a distance of the gut scale. The brains are explicitly in Hojava's construction, and then by assumption in this more general version, are connected by moduli that turn on some F-term of a parameter that stands in front of the gauge boson kinetic energy term. Out of this, you get a renormalization group boundary condition where the super partner fields are zero and where the Gugino masses are non-zero with some pattern which is associated with the identification of this modulus. And then you integrate the renormalization group equations down from the gut scale and you find the prediction of a definite pattern of superparticle masses, which then in principle you might or might not find experimentally. There's another version of this with a slightly different set of assumptions called anomaly mediation, devised by Landau and Sundrum and by Giudice et al. There, they say, the brains are not connected by any moduli that couple directly to the standard model fields. However, in that circumstance, radiative corrections induce a pattern of superparticle masses. The soft masses are proportional to some renormalization group coefficients, and you get a different but equally characteristic pattern of superparticle masses. The interesting prediction in this case is that the partners of the W's are typically very light and, in fact, almost degenerate. So this guy can be very long-lived and then decay to this unobserved neutral particle. This is actually a situation where this particle is not observed directly at the LHC because it is observed as essentially the end product of a cascade where this thing would then be missed, but the large missing energy associated with this one would be observed. At a linear collider, this might actually be imaged as a short-lived particle which then decays to a very soft pion and a lot of missing energy. But in any case,
a potential to be generated for these moduli. How does that affect the
discussion? Well, it depends how large the potential is. If the two brains are the gut scale apart, it probably doesn't make any difference. If the two brains are much further apart, then that could give a significant mass to the moduli and quench the effect on the previous slide. But I think it's hard to imagine a potential that's so large that you would make these particles massive on the gut scale.
The mass of the mod, it was only the F component of the modulus that enters primarily giving the Gugino's mass.
That's right.
Supersymmetry mass. So there, Suzy preserving mass as such would not directly enter.
Well, I'm sorry, it's a supersymmetric theory at the gut scale.
Yeah.
So the Suzy preserving mass is exactly the thing which is the exponential decay of the modulus from one brain to another. Okay. There are two brains. If you have a massive particle, there's some exponential decay of the effect from one brain to the other. And that's the Suzy preserving mass of the modulus. But I guess in all the examples I know, that's much too small to have a significant effect if the brains are one over M gut apart. If they're further apart, it can have a significant effect and cause a lot of moduli to drop out. And so if we talk, as we will slowly go, to large extra-dimension scenarios, that can be important.
And I'm thinking about, you know, wrapped brains and things like that, potentials for moduli. So
okay.
For example, you've had two versions of the width planes.
Yeah.
The other is about membrane distance.
Okay.
Between the realistic scenario that will induce. So actually, I would say the opposite of what you said. If they're close together, I would say that there's an important potential. And it's when they're far apart that that particular mechanism is not important.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So my question, it's really a question, it's not an attack.
Yeah.
It's a question. Is that, you know, shouldn't that be included in these analyses?
Well, I guess the answer to the question is yes. I mean, you know, we don't know what the answer is. These are two very simple possibilities. And in reality, you know, we hope that 10 years from now we will be presented with the answer to this question, and we, our job will be to give it some kind of geometrical interpretation. So, you know, all possibilities are open at this moment.
I think it's had a problem with negative stuff on the S-curves.
It does. And then we could go into, there's some number of cures to that problem.
Okay, this other prediction becomes pretty good.
That's right. It is possible to solve this model has a problem that it generates negative slepton masses, that this quantity is negative for the sleptons. There are solutions to that problem, three or four in the literature, and they have the property that this prediction is relatively unaffected. Some of them, it's not affected at all. Some of them, it's perturbed by a bit. Let me just put this slide up. So everything I'm talking about is really a caricature, much less than a detailed model. But I'd just like to show you that the spectra that these various scenarios predict, again, at the caricature level, really is very different. The spectra are made as close as possible by normalizing everything to the mass of the W partner or the trigeno. And here is the prediction of Gugino mediation or Hojava scenario. Here's the prediction on the same scale with a set to one of anomaly mediation. These are the negative slepton masses, which eventually have to be pushed to somewhere in here by adding something to this theory. This is the prediction of gauge mediation, the idea that there is a low-energy gauge group whose strong dynamics leads to supersymmetry breaking. And then Gugino mediation is the limit of something called gravity mediation, which Sergio wrote down the general formula for many years ago. And so gravity mediation somehow interpolates between this and this spectrum. You see here the sleptons are very light. You can turn on a parameter if you like to make them very heavy. So somehow all of this information is lurking there. We would really learn something if we knew what the spectrum was in the real world. And it seems to me that string theorists ought to make it a priority to make sure that the detailed information contained in this spectrum is measured. That's the point I wanted to make. So as usual, when you have any subject for which string theory impacts the outside world, the most clear statement of it can be found in Brian Greene's book. And so here's what he says. The masses and charges of the superpartners will reveal the detailed way in which supersymmetry is incorporated into the laws of nature. String theorists would then face the challenge of seeing whether this implementation, please excuse me, can be fully realized or explained by string theory. So I can't say it better than that. Well, if this is true, though, there's something else which is very important to say, and that is that it is important to realize that E plus E minus experiments are the best way to measure these parameters. You can find supersymmetry in a hadron collider. You can measure some subset of the masses, or in some case, mass differences between particles. But E plus E minus experiments, and in particular, E plus E minus experiments with polarized beams, have the capability of going places that the hadron collider experiments haven't dreamed of. And so I want to give you some examples of that. Roughly, the precision measurement of masses. So talking about measuring masses to below 1% from kinematic measurements, and if you actually look for the thresholds at which supersymmetric particles are created, you can go to parts per mil. The measurement of mixing angles. There are many examples where there are two superpartners with the same quantum numbers that mix experimentally. And one needs to measure not only the masses, but also the mixing angles, and sensitive searches for flavor dependence, flavor violation, CP violation, etc. in these parameters. So let me just flash through you a few examples of this. So, for example, this is some simulation done by the European group at a particular point in a model of E plus E minus to the partners of the muon, the left and right-handed muon. You folks all know that the left and right-handed muon have separate superpartners. Typically in models, they have a large mass difference between them, maybe a factor of 1.5 or 2 in some of these models. And in fact, it's very interesting to measure those masses precisely. The muon is a spin zero particle, so it decays, let's say, to a muon and the lightest neutralino, an unobserved particle. It decays isotropically. When you boost an isotropic distribution, what you get is a step function. And if you measure the kinematic endpoints of the step function, you can then just determine algebraically the mass of the parent, and if it decays to a muon and then some heavy unobserved particle, the mass of the heavy thing that it decays into. So the crucial thing is to measure the endpoints of this distribution, which are supposed to be very sharp. This one, according to the detector simulation, will be very sharp. This one is rounded by the effects of initial state radiation and what's called beamstrahlung, the radiation in the beam-beam interaction. However, that's an effect that you can measure and correct for. And so these guys conclude that from this distribution, one can get a few parts per mil measurement of this muon mass. Now, of course, there are two muons. You also have to measure the mass of the heavy one. So for that, you go up above...
For something like this, Michael, do you have any idea of how many
meters? This is about... These guys made actually a precise estimate. I think it's about between these two graphs. So there are two energies at which you run. Of course, these are not the only things you measure, because in this model, there's lots of other supersymmetric stuff at these energies. It's about 500 inverse femtobarns, and that's roughly 2 years of design luminosity. So you don't really need all, well, it depends what precision you want to get to, how many systematic checks, etc. For a few percent measurement, probably a tenth of that would suffice. And so then you have to basically find out what's there and then figure out where you're going to put your effort. But this paper is based on between these two points about 500 inverse femtobarns.
And what subplane is?
Sorry?
What subplane is?
Let's see. This, it's something like 200 and 250, no, lower than that. Maybe 150 and 200, yeah. So the energies running would be 350 and 500. Okay, you can work out from here if I tell you about what the masses are. Okay. Here what you do is that you look at the decay of the heavier muon to the second neutralino, which then decays to a lepton pair, so there's some four lepton signature. If you isolate that again, you can make a lepton energy distribution. Again, it's fairly sharp. And again, you have a sub 1% measurement of the masses of these particles. Okay. So here's another example done by Howie Baer at Florida State. This is the sneutrino decaying to an electron and a chargino, the W partner. You can use the chargino just to identify the events, then you throw it away. What we're interested in is the box-shaped distribution from the electron spectrum. And again, the precise measurement of the endpoints gives, in this case, please excuse me, 50 inverse femtobarns, I forget what, but a few percent measurement of the neutrino mass. Well, here's a slightly more exotic example. This is again from the European study. Let's think now about the top squark. The top squark is expected to be light because the same mechanism that makes the Higgs boson mass squared negative brings down the mass of the top squark. The top squawk also might be quite strongly mixed between the superpartner of the left-handed top and the superpartner of the right-handed top, both because of the top quark mass and because of this A parameter of which you would like to actually make a measurement. And this is the way you would do it, by measuring this mixing. The way to find the mixing angle, it turns out, is to make top squarks, let's say the lightest one, with polarized beams. If the top squark were unmixed, knowing its quantum numbers and knowing that it's just E plus E minus annihilation through a photon in a Z, you would have a precise prediction of its cross-section. If it's mixed, the cross-section varies with the mixing angle. And if you do the measurement with positively and negatively polarized electron beams, there are basically two cross-section measurements, which is a function of the mass of the top squark and the cosine of the mixing angle cross in a certain place. The mass is measured kinematically, so actually this is just a cross check on this axis. But this axis here measures the mixing angle. Here's another example of a mixing angle measurement with polarization of a rather different kind. So let's now think about the W partners. Actually, in supersymmetric models, there's a W and there's also a charged Higgs boson. And both of those have spin a half partners, so those partners have the same quantum numbers, and in general they mix with one another. So depending on the ratio of M2, the soft mass of the W superpartner, and U, the supersymmetric Higgs mass parameter, the lightest charged color-neutral superparticle may be either mostly Weno or mostly Higgsino. So a contour of constant mass would look like this in this diagram, and then over here. Down here, it's mostly Weno. Up here, it's mostly Higgsino. To find out how to tell the difference, you should look at the cross-section for E plus E minus two Trojino pairs. Now, I'll remind you that because this is a supersymmetric analog of W production, if you use a left-handed electron, this neutrino comes in, and you have to know what the mass of this neutrino is to predict the cross-section. Of course, if you can find this neutrino, you can make all that work. But if you use right-handed electrons, this neutrino cancels out. And then other things start happening, like a right-handed electron doesn't couple to SU2, but U1 doesn't couple to the W partner. So down here, you expect a very low cross-section, whereas if this thing is mostly Higgsino, you expect a very high cross-section. And you can see that if you were to actually measure this polarized cross-section, you could tell, except maybe for some ambiguity where it gets very small, exactly where you were on the constant mass contour. So those are two examples of how one can really go rather powerfully beyond just the simple measurement of masses to extract parameters in the effective Lagrangian. And then let me show you one more example, which again is from some work by Peter Zervos for the European E plus E minus study. So what Peter tried to do here was to take some color neutral superparticle masses as would be extracted from the kind of linear collider experiments that I showed you before, contrast those with some colored superparticle masses, the Gluino and the squarks, which might be measured at the LHC, and look at the extrapolation to very high energies to see whether these things had a grand unification. The interesting point is that the supersymmetric analog of color in the renormalization group equations generates some, in principle, large ambiguities in that extrapolation. So the thing that is really the clean test of grand unification is to compare, for example, the masses of the left and right-handed sleptons over here, the masses of the W and the B partners over here. And those are the things which it's the particular facility of the linear collider to measure very precisely. So in this whole program, then, there are big advantages of doing these experiments in E plus E minus, and I think great importance if you really want to know what these parameters are. So now, let me just take a few moments to discuss some less orthodox things. Many string models predict additional gauge bosons beyond the standard model gauge bosons. In pre-fermion constructions, you folks know there are often lots of new U1s which get mass, presumably not so far from the scale of SU2 plus U1 breaking. One other example is this Kakuzadze-Tai brain world model, for which you get the standard model gauge group inside the group 06 plus 04. And if those brains are actually large, then there are several more massive gauge bosons that you would find not so far above the standard model level. Well, there are lots of examples like this. So I think for string people who are interested in strings, it's interesting to think about how you would look for new gauge bosons and measure their quantum numbers. And the best way to look for new gauge bosons, as is well appreciated, is to look for a gauge boson that decays to L plus L minus, and you look for PP goes to something plus a lepton pair coming out of the LHC. So it's a beautiful experiment. You find a typically a very narrow mass peak, and you identify that there are new neutral gauge bosons in nature by that measurement. But, of course, when you found it, you have to ask, what is it? So there, you would like to have more probes of what the couplings of this new boson are. And in fact, there's a very large set of probes, which are exactly the generalization of the experiments I told you folks about yesterday. E plus E minus going to photon plus Z plus new Zs going to fermion pairs. So the new Z, even if it's quite massive, will perturb this reaction, and the perturbation will be characteristic of the flavor of the pair, the handedness of the electron, the handedness of the final product. If it's a tau, as I showed you yesterday, that can be measured. And so you can look in particular at all of the angular distributions and asymmetries. Here's a plot. I'm not sure how much information one can extract from it, but Steve Godfrey, oh, also some of the captions are missing, please excuse me, but Steve Godfrey made a chart of just the different ways that you sample properties of a new gauge boson at a linear collider: the total cross-section, the hadron to lepton fraction, polarization asymmetry, B and C fraction, etc.
What happens if you have several?
Sorry?
Several.
If you have several and they're all well above threshold, you measure some sum rule for them. Then you have to go to higher energy to separate it. Hopefully the LHC will tell us what the pattern is, and then, you know, as high as you can get in energy, you have to fit that. I guess the other thing I wanted to show you is that already at 500 GeV, the sensitivity you have in this kind of indirect way is comparable to the direct mass sensitivity of the LHC. Here's a chart that Tom Rizzo made up for, well, various kinds of new U1s that people have tried to put into models. 200 inverse femtobonds, so that's sort of a year of running at the canonical luminosity. And then that's compared to up to what energy you can see the mass peak at the LHC. So it's quite a complementary program. If you can find the peak in these experiments, you really can learn something about it.
If the mass of this thing is within the range of the accelerator, you could actually see it much more dramatically by direct.
Right, but that's practically excluded. These things are excluded up to about 800 GeV now.
Okay,
it could still be at 1,000. I mean, right. You know, frankly, if the thing were at 1,500,
right,
it would be much easier to build the E plus E minus collider that could go to it, because you could work with much less luminosity. but we can't count on that, unfortunately, when we design the accelerator. Okay. Well, finally, in the most optimistic scenario, the extra dimensions predicted by string theory might have sizes of order 1 over TeV or even larger. And then there's all kinds of fun things you can say about that. So let me just brush through that very quickly. Of course, if you have TeV scale extra dimensions, you would expect, as Greg said, numerous new Z bosons, which would be just the Kaluza-Klein excitations on this scale. And in fact, their pattern would reflect the shape of the extra dimensions. So here's an interesting prediction for the LHC that Pran Nath, Yamada, and Yamaguchi published, where essentially by taking a, I think, these two curves are two-dimensional tori, different orbifolds of them, and you have a different pattern of Kaluza-Klein gauge bosons in some way that probably you folks would consider very obvious, but...
Sorry? Some cross-section.
Okay. So this is the cross-section for lepton pair production as a function of the mass of the lepton pair. So every bump essentially is a Kaluza-Klein excitation. And then obviously... That's right. It's on a log scale, so if it were on a linear scale, this would look like a delta function. And clearly, as you take different orbifolds of the torus, there's some different pattern there which you can detect.
There isn't a lot of junk sitting on top of this.
It's a clean background here.
There's no backside to this curve.
Well, actually, lepton pairs are very clean at hadron colliders. But the drug end,
besides this spectrum of Kaluza-Klein excitations of the Z.
No, well, what? I mean, the drug end cross section at the tevatron, it's very clean. It basically just comes from photons and Zs making lepton pairs. It's one of the few things at a hadron collider which really is clean. Okay. Then, of course, if you like very large extra dimensions, as in the scenario of Arkani, Hamed, Demopoulos, and Diwali, there are other kinds of interesting things that you can say. Here, there are just a few points that I'd like to make. First of all, again, the kinds of methods that we've talked about are very interesting in this case. For example, if you have now, at high energy, some kind of strong gravity, because the gravitational scale has come down to the TEV region, then you expect gravity or strings or something to perturb these E plus E minus the two fermion cross-sections. Various people, J.N. Hewitt and Tao Han and Judice, have looked at what happens if you just put in a contact interaction, T mu. The effects are really quite dramatic. This is some predictions for E plus E minus to BB bar. Here in the angular distribution as a function of cosine theta, and here the forward-backward asymmetry as a function of cosine theta. And the fact that these curves wiggle back and forth around the standard model prediction is actually the indication that it's spin-2 exchange. So, in principle, if this were there, you could be sensitive to it. In a similar way, you can look for, in these experiments, gravitational radiation. And maybe this is actually a quite model-independent way of putting bounds on the size of extra dimensions. Let me just put this slide of the reach of these gravitational radiation experiments. So these are actually the current bounds from experiments which have been done, which look for E plus E minus or QQ bar going to one jet or one electron or a photon plus missing energy. You see that already LEP2 and the tevatron are, for various numbers of large extra dimensions, getting up to the TEV region. And in the future, the linear collider and the LHC will go really quite far into multi-TEV as far as probing where the gravitational scale is.
Sorry, just to understand, N is the scale that suppresses this contact?
Well, actually, in these experiments, N is the true... So this calculation is done in the following way. You assume a torus compactification, flat extra dimensions, with M being the true Planck scale of the theory, okay? And then you get limits on that parameter in this very simple scenario, and these are the kind of limits you get. And
what are those asterisks?
Oh, I'm sorry. This is, for two extra dimensions, this is actually the strongest limit. This is the limit from the fact that supernova 1987A doesn't radiate away most of its energy in gravitational radiation. And it's actually 50 TeV in this column. That corresponds to 3 microns, in case you're interested in small gravity experiments, you might want to take that into account. And on the other hand, this bound here for six extra dimensions from the LHC would correspond to three Fermi radius with six extra dimensions compactified at that scale. Okay. So as I said, this gives you some idea of where we are now and how far we can push in the future. And again, these two experiments, although I've written them here in some competitive way, they're complementary because at the LHC you have more energy, so somehow you get a further reach. At the linear collider, because you know where the center of mass is, you can measure more things about the missing energy process.
Michael, I don't know how people did these calculations, but I was just looking at a numerical trend.
Yes.
For anchor 2, the numbers go down. For anchor 6, they sort of go up 100, 500, 700. Why is that?
The supernova, of course, is at very low energy. So the low, so these cross-sections go up as a very high power of the center of mass energy. And so at low end, and the power is higher as you have more and more extra dimensions because it's just phase space. If the phase space goes to the nth power.
Okay,
so that's absolutely the correct thing. The lowest energy, the lowest center of mass energy is most powerful when n is small. The highest energy is most powerful when n is large. Okay, and of course, if the Planck scale is at TeV energies, the string scale should also be found there. So you expect to see not only gravitational radiation, but string excited states, resonances. The resonances should decay 10% of the time to missing energy. Dramatic increases in the standard model cross-sections. The standard model cross-sections become much more forward. It's the natural prediction of string theory. And somewhere in here, there's an interesting story about how this is connected at high energy to the limit of black hole scattering, which actually it would be very interesting if someone would really work out in detail.
Black hole scattering or production?
What is...
Could that be plus C minus goes to black hole?
Oh, no, I guess what I'm thinking of is as an electron gets to very high energy, it has its Schwarzschild... Black hole production is what I meant.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And you folks might remember that at the conference a year and a half ago here, I showed this funny slide of the prediction of the Bava scattering cross-section as a function of energy from 800 to 1600 for the case where the string scale is at 1 TeV, which is actually the current experimental limit from Fermilab. And there are resonances in this theory at 1 TeV, at the square root of 2 TeV, at the square root of 3 TeV, and a crazy pattern of the angular distribution as you go up in energy through these resonances. And I'm not saying the world has to be like this, but I guess what I am saying is that if the world could be like this, and we didn't really try to find out, then what are we doing? So let's now try and find out. And now we come to the next part, which is, what do I want you to do about it? So now, I've given you a certain case that E plus E minus experiments have a number of phenomena that they can measure. I think the case is very strong in supersymmetry and is really worth you guys looking further into it. And then, of course, also for these other phenomena with mu z's, large extra dimensions, and other things. But now, what I want to say on the next few slides are independent of whether or not you agree with this case. Let's put that aside, and I'd just like to say some things about what I think you folks should be doing. Again, let me point out to you that the U.S. high energy physics community is debating its future this year, that DOE and NSF have convened a panel which has requested, and they have requested a report on the future of high energy physics in the United States. And I think that the needs of string theory ought to play an important role in their conclusions, and you guys should really take this seriously. So how do you do this? Well, zero is You should join the American Physical Now... Let me say something about this. The reason for this is that this panel and the DOE and the NSF communicate with the community through the Division of Particles and Fields. So if you're not a member of the Division of Particles and Fields, you're totally out of the loop. So when I was asking to give this talk, I was talking to one of the organizers of this N-theory workshop, complaining that a lot of young theorists just didn't think it was worth their time to join the American Physical Society. And, well, I don't really want to badmouth anyone in particular by name, but certainly I won't badmouth... anyone who's here. But this particular organizer of the M-Theory Workshop told me that he had never bothered to join the American Physical Society. Well, I'd also like to point out that the APS controls other subjects that string theorists care about, in particular the future of journal publishing. And so it really is worth your time to connect up with this organization.
Why don't we have your call?
How many APS members are
you? Well, there is a member, please raise your hand.
Lots.
So number one is, I think it's really worth taking some time out of your life to think about how string theory could potentially be tested experimentally in the next 20 years. What I'm telling you is that it's urgent, and that you don't have to get a definitive answer, but you should have, I think, a thought-out answer to this question. I've talked a lot about the SUSY spectrum. Of course, one can also think about other kinds of new interactions at high energy. Of course, cosmology, modifications of gravity, the identity of dark matter. Maybe there are exotic candidates for dark matter which have different signatures, which would be very interesting. There's a whole story to be worked out here. And I think everyone in the community can figure out his or her own favorite best way of finding a uniquely stringy phenomenon. But this is something that really deserves attention. What should experimenters be searching for? And let me remind you that just in the same way as we think of string theory as an enterprise played out over decades where we slowly develop bits and pieces of what would be the final theory, experimenters think about their experiments as something that is played out over decades, where you, to take an accelerator, it takes 10 years, to build a detector, it takes 5 years, presumably much planning before that. A large high-energy detector will run for 10 years, or maybe 15 years. And so one needs to get started in the right direction. And I think to prod experimenters to start in directions that are very useful is, I think, a very important thing. And this is the most important thing I'm going to tell you. Don't wimp out on this one, because people out there want to know, if string theory is right, how are we going to find out? And even guesses are better than just saying, I'm not interested in that subject. So once you've done the exercise that I mentioned in the previous slide, you should write a letter to the HEPAP subpanel telling them what your conclusions are. Please don't bother with the fact that your conclusions are not rigorous or definitive, because no one else's are either. Nobody knows what we're going to find in the next decade in energy, but I think it's important to say that some things, if they were observed, would be very interesting for showing the identity of fundamental theory. And I think that is at least as valuable as anything that this panel has to hear from a typical experimenter. So you should do this. In January 2001, there was a panel constituted. The co-chairs are Barry Barish and John Bagger. They are charged to report on the following questions. They are asked explicitly, what are the central questions that define the intellectual frontier of high-energy physics? They asked for a recommendation for the next high energy physics facility, and they asked for a 20-year plan.
20 years ago was 1981.
Yeah.
Do you think that anyone could have made a plan in 1981?
Well, let me remind you.
What we've been doing in the past.
Let me remind you that in 1982, the SSC was called for.
I was actually one that moved that
plan. Yeah.
81, that time they shut down Isabel.
Right.
Now the Red Tunnel. And they decided to go to the SSC, which, if it had been canceled, would have been running now.
Right, and we'd know today whether a supersymmetry was there or not.
So that actually was the force, I mean, at that time, the force I mean, now we're
Okay. Of course, you know, David's panel gave all the wrong reasons, but nevertheless, it would have been the right answer. We know in retrospect it would have been the right answer. And if you want to know... That's fine.
So does this happen once in 20 years?
Sorry?
Does this happen once in 20 years?
Let's wait for the next slide. I'll answer that question. Their draft report is due October 1st, so you'd better do this before then. And if you want to know everything there is to know about this panel, here's the web address. You can look it up.
It's amazingly short date, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
For a panel of this comprehensive scope to have that scheduled, because that's
not when the report is finished.
The report is due January 1st, but they want the conclusions they're asking for them by October 1st. Okay. I'd like to say a few more things about this. Of course, I'm asking you to write a letter to Barish and Bagger, not necessarily agreeing with what I've said in this seminar, but agreeing with your deep thoughts about how to potentially test string theory. And I think if the string theory community thinks that they're the people with the vision, you guys ought to demonstrate that to this panel. Now, in answer to Hiroshi's question, the previous such panel met in 1996 to 98. They had a community meeting at Snowmass 96, which as far as I know was not attended by anyone with credentials in the string theory community. In fact, Strings 96, which was held here, conflicted with it. At Strings 96, Lenny Susskind gave a memorable lecture already referred to, saying that all we needed was pure thought. No, I think it was Strings 96.
The one you gave was 95.
96 was here, wasn't it? No, 96 was here. Oh, I'm sorry. This was the after dinner talk. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I get that wrong? 95. Please excuse me. Okay. And maybe I should say this panel didn't make any progress.
The panel was not good in the charge.
That's fine.
I mean, to answer Hiroshi's question, this is a slightly unusual occasion. There's never been a panel with this panel. The usual question really is, assume you'll get $10 million, $750 million, $750 million, $750 million, maybe the agency, maybe micromanaged. This is a very broad charge. And which gives this panel a lot more importance.
Okay. But David, to be fair, these issues were all on the table in 1996. The SSC had just been canceled.
The string theorists for the panel not coming to definitive conclusions,
no,
prioritizing or making any leisure calls. They're not allowed.
I don't blame only the string theorists, but the string theorists definitely sat this one out. Okay, and finally, as I said, there is a community workshop in Snowmass, so if you folks are really eager, you could actually go there. It'll be held the first 3 weeks in July, You could talk to experimenters, you could try and persuade them of the importance of the measurements that you find especially interesting. It is not necessary to compute cross-sections or run Monte Carlos. Professionals in these areas will be its nomads. What you guys have to do is to bring the new ideas that people in the experimental community haven't heard of, which they need to know, because that's what 10 years from now they're going to want to be testing. That's what they need to know, and you guys have to tell them. And Witten, Gross, Polchinski, and Dine will be at this workshop, so why not you? And again, there's a URL if you want to find out more information. So that's the end of the lecture. The experimental verification of string theory is far off, but I think we have to keep it in sight. The necessary experiments are themselves very long-range programs, and the people who are going to do those experiments need guidance from you guys. And I think it's important that you should get into the act and try and give them some guidance so that they can head in the right directions. So thank you very much.
Any questions? Greg?
I agree with what you're saying, but I really want to take issue with otherwise we are only doing recreational mathematics. I think that's really a wrong point of view. String theory has had very profound applications and impact on mathematics. Mathematics is a justifiable intellectual subject. And it's not just recreational.
Okay. So if you cross out recreational, what would you have?
Well, I would also cross out only. I'm dead serious.
Okay.
Come on, little mathematics. And the one thing that string theory has really done is had a very profound impact on mathematics. It has changed mathematics, and it has had a very profound intellectual effect on the way mathematicians.
Greg, your point is absolutely well taken.
This is,
Greg, for the sake of mathematics, we should go and
do it.
I'm sorry.
That's by saying I agree with. But I strongly disagree with saying that the mathematical applications and implications of string theory are only recreational mathematics.
Okay.
I think that's really a wrong point of view.
Okay, your point is well taken, you're absolutely correct. But on the other hand, I think that physicists think there's a lot more at stake here than proving theorems. It's really the question of how the world is built. And I think that, certainly for me, if string theory were just about proving theorems, I wouldn't be interested in it. That's my own opinion.
But yeah, that's. I would not say there's more at stake. I would say there's something else at stake.
Yeah.
This sounds like a debate which might continue outside.
No, I don't have all the discussions.
Okay.
We might have been a lot provocative remarks from many people. Asking questions will respond.
Hey, watching, you have a question.
Yeah, you mentioned that Germany and Japan are also looking at next linear collider. How do the U.S. plan and those two countries plan this putting together? What are the possible scenarios there in terms of being built in another country or being built?
At various times in the past 10 years, various countries have been through the most likely site of this machine. I think in the early 90s, when the Japanese economy was very flush, the Japanese were talking about a, let's say, 300 to 500 GeV linear collider as a Japanese national project. And they were saying, Sugawara, the head of KK, said, they can do it as a national project. Maybe other parts of the people in the world could contribute small amounts. That statement has pretty much completely gone away now. First of all, of course, the Japanese economy has collapsed. There are various sort of science politics questions which are special to Japan, which have come in the way of this. But their latest sort of national panel has called for, as their first priority, the Linear Collider, but as an international project, which they would hope to host in Japan. For the past about 5 years, NLC, which is the American project, SLAC, LBL, Livermore, and Fermilab, has been in a collaboration with the JLC, the Japanese project. The two projects have basically the same technology, and there's been a conscious effort to merge the parameter sets. So those two groups are basically calling for the same accelerator, which might be built, you know, here or there. Probably today, the group which is furthest ahead as far as the political approval of the accelerator are the Germans. At the end of March, DAISY submitted a proposal for an accelerator called TESLA, which would be a superconducting technology accelerator, 500 GeV, extendable to 800 GeV. It would actually have one end on the DAISY site, and then it kind of goes northwest off into the countryside there. The proposal is very interesting because, unlike the American proposal, it has an integrated synchrotron light source. And they've been trying, that is to say, use the linear accelerator as a free electron laser in the X-ray region. And they've been trying to get some fraction of the support from the condensed matter physics community.
And they actually have a cost estimate.
Everybody has a cost estimate. And the cost estimates aren't so different. We could discuss that in great detail if you like. Their cost estimate is 3.8 billion euros. And how that compares to the number of $5 billion that I quoted here before for the American project, actually I believe it's greater when you do the numbers, so we can talk about that later. In any case, it's a very large amount of money, and the Germans say they can't do it unless there is a very substantial international participation, which I think means us.
Does that mean us, or does that mean CERN, or what does that mean?
Well, you have to remember that CERN is building their own $5 billion accelerator during the period that we're talking about, right? And they, as Sergio already told you, CERN has proposed something that would be a competitor to this machine as a possible next stage of CERN after the LHC. So how the politics of that work out, he will have to explain to you, because I don't understand it. If the thing will be built in Hamburg, it will have to involve some kind of substantial American participation. Now, which of these alternatives will be chosen, which technology will be chosen, it's very unclear. Over the next year, there will be a technical panel to evaluate the two technologies. And one of the things that I hope very much will come from that panel, and I think people I've talked to who will be on it are serious about it, to really understand what the relative cost is. You know, how much would it cost to build TESLA at Fermilab, for example? And then, you know, but somehow what you want to do is to divorce the question of what's the technology. You can use either one to achieve these goals from where it should be. And where it should be is presumably what country is willing to pay most of the cost of the accelerator, with the others giving relatively smaller fractions. How that will work out is very subtle. I remind you that for half a billion dollar contribution to the LHC, it was an enormous political battle in Congress. And the mood in Congress hasn't changed very much since then. So, my own feeling is that the best bet for a substantial American contribution is to actually have it be built here. But then there's a higher slope, because then you really have to ask for the three rather than the $1 billion contribution. It's very unclear. I mean, no one knows how this is going to work out. But unless the American community makes a clear statement that this is the kind of physics they want to do, it's not going to happen. So that's the first thing. That has to be settled first. Then we can go on and see, you know, where it can be built, how much money can be gotten, etc.
Maybe you should let the representatives are, especially your answer to the question. This machine is absolutely missing. Maybe you're not seeing anything in it.
Why decide now? Why don't we wait for the next run? Not to figure out what it's going to be. Sure, it's going to be a special time.
Well, that's
the year.
That's a question that you hear very often, and I think the answer has several aspects to it. I mean, one aspect has to be that the probability that you will be able to do interesting experiments at this accelerator is very high. And certainly, even if you discount the thing I was arguing with Mark about whether it's likely or not likely that supersymmetry will be found at the first stage, in almost every scenario, the Higgs boson is found at the first stage. You can do experiments and really characterize the Higgs boson, and then you can try and expand this machine to higher energy. The second part of it is, well, what about those scenarios where the Higgs boson even is not found? And there, you have to ask how big the phase space is. Frankly, I think it's very small. I've defended this in a paper that I wrote with Jim Wells earlier this year. And what we pointed out was that even for the counterexamples, the thing you want to do is a much higher level precision electroweak program, which is actually one of the things that you could do with this accelerator if it's the only thing you have to do. On the other hand, the opportunity is very large. And even if 500 GeV isn't enough energy, the way you would build an accelerator of 1 TeV or 1.5 would be first you would learn how to operate this machine, and then you'd upgrade it in energy. The muon collider is 15 years before we can make a construction start. There isn't another plausible technology to get at these questions except for E plus E minus. And I think if we want to do it eventually, it's really imperative that we start on it.
Hi.
Yes.
You want us to support the $5 billion investment, right? So I think we should be sure that the technology you're suggesting is the best we have. So I don't see how fast you reply to a counterexample. Imagine you want to build an accelerator which is just one wing of electrons. There will be an electron-proton collider with the other wing supplied by Develtron, right? One more wing linearly
creating
electrons colliding with protons from Develtron.
Right.
Worse than this.
Yeah, actually, this is something people have studied. It turns out that this configuration has all of the disadvantages of E plus E minus and PP. And in fact, there is an existing example, HERA, which has a search reach markedly smaller than LEP2, for example, a comparable E plus E minus facility. The difficulty is that in electron quark scattering, there's no annihilation channel that gives you the vacuum. I mean, the beauty of electron-positron scattering, or for the LHC, gluon-gluon scattering, is that when you scatter, you end up with vacuum quantum numbers, and then you can literally produce anything. But in EP, or in fact in quark-quark scattering, you can only produce the very special things that have the right quantum numbers. And that's ultimately where the limitation comes from. Yes.
Two questions. Well, one was definite one about what's your opinion about the new political atmosphere and the new fears about the American economy and what that might have, what impact that might have. And then the other question, which maybe Sergio knows more about, is the issue. Well, I saw a few months ago the prototype of the CERN machine, and I wondered whether is there any discussion between the various proposals for staging these things, because so I said, oh, that's the next linear collider. And I said, well, maybe it's the next linear collider.
Yeah.
I just wondered how much dialogue is there between the different people sort of thinking on a planetary scale about the physics.
Well, let's see. So the first question I'm just going to punt on, I have no idea what I mean, Washington is not my department. Please excuse me. I don't know what the effect of the Bush administration is. I don't know what the effect of the new economic changes is. I can't give you an intelligent answer to that question. The other question I can give you an intelligent answer to, the fact that click is now being considered seriously as a facility that you could build at CERN has a lot to do with the development of the click design, which owes a lot to the contribution of some of my colleagues at Slack, in particular Ron Ruth and Tor Rabenheimer. So CLIC used to be based on a superconducting accelerator model where the superconductivity limited the critical field and it limited the gradients. Through a collaboration with those people and some other people from Slack and other places, the CLIC design was altered to something which is what the accelerator guys call a fully loaded normal conducting design. And now, that's right, the two beam idea is the original click idea. But they realized that this can be realized with normal conducting cavities, which in principle should support hundreds of MeV per meter accelerating fields. And in fact, at Slack, there's a lot of talk, and in fact, it's even reflected in one of these slides. Where is it? Let me just find it so you can see that you've seen it. There it is. Okay. Where essentially you put down a footprint with the property that if you were to replace the NLC technology, which would be X-band klystrons, with two-beam technology, then on the same footprint you could get a higher energy. And that actually has some effect on this design already. For example, they used to have here something called the big bend, where you would bend the beam and try and clean up the muon halo that comes with it. And they've decided that that's a problem you can solve in other ways, so that you could take the beam directly into this interaction region, and then that is something that would be compatible with higher energy operation. Another thing is that recently, Pantaleo Raimondi at Slack has designed a new final focus. So essentially the thing that squeezes down these bunches to very small size, which is actually scalable to 3 TeV. And so although you know the two beam accelerating...
3 TeV if you're not sitting on a bump,
like
luminosity, I mean, how small do you have
to make the beam? Well, you need a 10 to the 35 luminosity. At 3 TeV. So you need a fraction of a nanometer, actually, in one direction.
Does the calorimetry technology, does that have to be seriously rethought?
No, calorimetry is on a log scale. So that's not very important. I mean, the really crucial thing is the luminosity. The cross-sections go down like the square of the energy. And so you have to make the bunches smaller and more powerful in a way that compensates that scaling. That's really what the hard problem is. Okay. Please.
Claire, just to follow. Okay. I mean, just going back to your exhortation, string theories, I just wanted to make an obvious comment and then people can tell me what's not so right about it. But the obvious comment about trying to connect string theory to phenomenology is that if the string scale is much higher than the TeV scale, then our best hope is to try and make very detailed predictions about the energy world. Namely, you know, at some true level, the gauge groups look promising and so on, but we've got to do better. And somehow this time doesn't seem right for that today. Maybe after we understand the possibility constant better and so on.
Well, large extra dimensions have raised a completely new set of possibilities. Okay. There are others.
So maybe I don't find, it's possible that the string scale is a TeV scale, but from the point of view of string theory, per se, that is not a particularly promising scenario. Maybe it is played out. But if it's not, just for a moment, then isn't the time a little bit early to start?
Is it possible to agree with that?
I think that a lot of, the deep brains and the strongly coupled dualities really opens the possibility to give potentials for moduli and do a more serious exploration.
You think those are the low energy projections?
The real stumbling block, as I see it, is to have some control on the Kähler potentials in supergravity.
But the super potential is something that we now have a lot of new techniques to address, and people are thinking hard, right, about non-particularly generated super potentials.
I think the point Michael's trying to make is not so much that, you know, what's needed, especially in the short term. Remember, this is an argument about a particularly important period. It's not that the analysts need detailed new scenarios, although some of the new ideas have excited them, and it's important. Because they're exciting ideas, and it's important that they be excited about ideas, period. But that you can measure them kind of thing that, you know, they're more than just Michael who is, you know, selling an LC, or might be viewed in that way.
Yeah, who is definitely viewed in that way.
But people who have, you know, just an interest in this kind of physics and buy into, just say particularly what he said at the beginning, you know, supersymmetry, we're all convinced, right? It's a part of nature, and sooner or later it'll be discovered, and its discovery and elucidation of that sector is of great importance to us. It will give us a lot of clues.
Yeah,
and that's what you have to tell these finalists. You know, there's these string theories. Great, there's all these wonderful things. And because it's, you know, for that very reason, we're so interested in these wonderful experiments that people do it and run to and LHC and this machine. And, you know, it has to come from totally neutral people like a lot of people in this room who don't, you know, aren't sitting in Slack and justifying NLC.
So,
the physics.
In this context, I have a question.
Yes.
So, with due respect to all these theorists who have studied supersymmetric breaking mechanisms, it's quite possible that they are all wrong, in the sense that they all predict the large cosmological constant. And so it may be that the experiment will reveal the pattern of supersymmetry gradient, which we totally don't expect, and that would be a great thing for everyone. Mm-hmm. And then that, so how, why is it that E plus E minus E minus experiment to tell us more information about that particular aspect of supersymmetry?
Well, this is the general point that I made about this, that ultimately, all of this information is encoded in the effective Lagrangian of soft supersymmetry breaking parameters. And E plus E minus is just a very beautiful way to measure those parameters unambiguously one by one. So I showed you how to measure individual particle masses. I showed you how to measure A terms. I showed you how to measure the new parameter. All of those statements are independent of what these parameters are. The only thing I've assumed is that the particles are accessible to E plus E minus at the energies that will reach.
There is nothing that Hadron driver can do that E plus E minus can.
I'm sorry? Yeah. What I'm saying is that E plus E minus offers you a way to measure in a theoretically unambiguous way the various parameters of the effective Lagrangian. Now, if you look at what has been studied for the LHC can, in fact, discover supersymmetry. It can measure some number of particle masses. And in fact, it was quite surprising to me when people really worked out how much you can do. But typically, what you come down to is a measurement of particle masses or mass differences. You don't have control of polarization. You don't have control of the center of mass energy. So ultimately, you're analyzing some decay chain which stands up above the background. And there is much that you can't do. It depends. In some scenarios, you can measure some parameters. In some scenarios, you can measure others. There's a 60-page article on this in the Atlas Technical Design Report. And it's interesting to see what they can do. But always, I think, you have to have a model of the whole spectrum, and you have to be testing that model and determining parameters of it, rather than going in without prejudice and saying, I can pick out this Lagrangian coefficient and I can measure it. So I think the more surprising is the phenomenon we're going to find, the more you need these kind of experiments, which are completely unambiguous as to their interpretation. Yes.
Michael, I think one of the the sticking points of all this in the experimental community is the fact that initially it's a jump in energy from 200 to 500, which is a factor of 2.5. And way back in history, there was a Drell subpanel report that said something, it's actually on a white piece of paper about a 1 TeV. So this issue of the upgradability, which is this magic word that you get to put down with relatively low effort, but in reality is not a low effort, is of great importance, I think.
Yes.
Of going from 500 GeV, where you might characterize the situation as having significant risk of non-discovery, to 1 TeV, where it's less significant risk of not a discovery. And so I guess I wonder, on the time scale of the next, period, which is so short before this report is ultimately going to be written, how well are we going to understand the issues associated with upgrading to 1 TeV?
Well, upgrading to 1 TeV is
just money. I think there are technical issues.
Well,
I'd like to know that. Okay. If somebody says that the technical issues have all been solved, I'm not even sure the technical issues have all been solved for a 500 GeV machine.
Okay. It's not true. There is one specific technical issue that we can discuss, which has to do with the limitations on gradients in copper cavities, which people are working very hard on now. Quite likely that will be understood by the fall.
That's for the
Sorry?
Or for 500.
Well, after that, it's all money. This is not actually needed to build a 500 GeV machine, but this issue would be needed for the upgrade.
Tesla, I think, claims.
Tesla has, again, there's, you can argue about what the situation is. There, the mechanism for creating positrons in Tesla is very shaky, and that has to be looked at, but they would claim that there are no significant issues, no showstoppers. I think the NLC people would claim pretty much the same thing. There are no showstoppers. Both of these accelerators require several years of engineering work before you would put a spade in the ground. And that's just true.
What if...
And at that level, Jeff, I should say that 500 to 1 TeV is just a matter of money. Do you or do you not build in facilities that would allow you, in the summer to install more klystrons and raise the energy?
Does it scale pretty much linearly? Does it make it go from 5 to 10 or 5 to 7?
No. It's about, I'm not sure whether it's 5 to 6 or 5 to 7, but it's relatively small once you've put that infrastructure in.
Because building it to be upgradable is expensive. It costs more than it would.
Yeah.
Well.
Then the extra cost isn't so much.
But yeah.
But the cost to build it in such a way that it's cheaply upgradable.
If it were not upgradable, I think you have a big problem.
Yeah.
Now, there could very well be a pressure to build it even lower at the state.
That's right.
So it might not even end up in 500 GeV except at the stage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you could certainly imagine, if you really thought that LEP had discovered the Higgs, you might want to start at 350, the top threshold, where you could also do the light Higgs, and then continuously upgrade.
That's money and power.
Right. So eventually, I think this panel has to come to some crisp statement of what is it the community wants and how much do they want to pay for it. And that's a political decision. It's not a scientific decision. But of course, the other thing which you have to remember is that SLAC was originally designed as a 17 GeV linear accelerator, and today it runs at 50 GeV, and hasn't gotten any longer if people are more clever at how they make RF and how they put RF into it. And I think with linear accelerators as opposed to synchrotrons, there's a history that says that as you learn more things, you can raise the energy.
Well,
Okay.
Thanks again.